Well, summer is officially here, and we're going to talk about what exactly the summer solstice is, what to make of the heat spell, lack of rain in early June, and get a forecast of Wisconsin weather ahead of our holiday weekend. Larry Mueller here with our weather guys back. Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to see your smiling face.
It's great to see you as well, even though it's two-dimensional. Looking forward to the day we get together physically.
Me too. John Martin here as well, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to see you as well.
Good to see you too, Larry. Yeah, we're looking forward to getting into that new studio that was endlessly being revised before we had to be pack everything up on campus. We're looking forward to that.
Well, it won't be long now, we'll be back Great. Together again. But for now, as you're listening to the show, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What summer weather questions do you have? Are you feeling the effects of the heat and dry spell earlier in June? What are your severe weather questions? Join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us to ideas at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Well, last Sunday was the official start of summer. Happy summer to you both. What exactly is the summer solstice?
So the summer solstice is more of an astronomical marking for summer. It's when, if you were to draw an imaginary line from the center of the sun to Earth, it's when it gets its furthest poleward. So it gets to the Tropic of Cancer, I guess it is, at 23.5 degrees. And that's when we have the Northern Hemisphere. We have our most sunlight hours during that time. It always occurs around June 21st. There's some variability with time because orbits have a little wobble in it as well, sort of like tops, if you will. Meteorologically, we tend to start summer on June 1. So the summer months meteorologically are June, July, and August. But astronomically, it begins on around June 21st.
Well, it's always a sad day in some ways, in that we know from there on out the days are going to. Daylight's going to get shorter.
Shorter. But, you know, it's still light out at around 9 o'clock. So, you know, we could still get out and get outside. But, yeah, we know the sun is moving further south, and you can track it if you watch sunsets every day. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Somebody asked, what is the solar noon? Is
solar noon is when it is directly – when the sun is directly overhead. So okay. It's not directly overhead,
highest
except at the equator.
Sky.
It's the highest point in the sky.
Yeah.
So at sunrise, sunset, it's on the horizon. At some point, it reaches a peak. And that solar noon, it gets higher and higher up until June 21st. Then it's up its highest in the sky, and then it'll start retreating southward as we move and get ready for the winter solstice.
And it's also the worst time of the day to take a photo of somebody, if you're out doing it outside.
If you're right, yes.
Well, John, we had quite a heat spell in early June. It seemed earlier than usual. Was it? And did we break any records?
Here in town, I don't think we broke any, or in the southern part of the state, I don't think we broke any daily high record temperatures, but we had several in a row that were over 90. I think we ended up with 5 days or something over 90 already, maybe more than that even, maybe as high as 7. So it's a really warm start to the month, and that coincided with a dry start to the month, which luckily since the 18th we've sort of made up on. We've in Madison anyway, 3.91 inches of rain since the 18th of June. So that's just in 10 days. And boy, did we need it. We were running 7-ish inches below normal since April 1, and we're kind of made up about a little more than half that deficit now. So that's really good news, probably for a lot of the agriculture and certainly people trying to keep their own gardens and whatnot in good shape.
It's interesting, though, the way the rain came. Maybe a mile or two from the Madison Capitol Square, And they were, the other day, they were saying, well, the square, there's over an inch of rain falling, and here I am a mile away, and I've got like five drops.
I had the exact same experience looking out my window one day in the office to the south, you know, looking at the Beltline in Fitchburg. It's pouring rain, and we didn't get a drop in town that same day. So I forget what day it was, but yeah. But then it's become a little more widespread. I think just about everybody's felt some of this 3.9 inches of rain over the last 10 or so days. But it started out pretty parsimonious.
Yeah, I had the opposite. I was on the phone with somebody, and we're talking, and all of a sudden, it is pouring at my house. And I'm just like, oh, my goodness, it's pouring out. And they're like, what? Huh? I don't have anything.
Oh, man. Len from Mazamani says he admits to procrastinating and meant to call about 3 months ago to ask about the spring solstice. He noticed in Madison the day and night were not exactly 12 hours each. What's the deal with that? He thought that occurred everywhere that day. In fact, the 12 hours each occurred about 4 days before.
Yeah, you know, I remember now I think this individual wrote me an email asking that same question. The part of the problem was when I went and look at the tables where you can monitor that, they don't go to the second. So they round it off to a minute. And so it's hard to really tell that it is 12 hours everywhere of day and night on the solstice. So you need to find that accurate right. And the naval lab actually keeps pretty close track of that time zone changes.
Yeah. Carl in Portage, your turn. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, I'm glad to be on your show. Would you please explain the analemma, which is a graph with a vertical axis and a horizontal axis. Explain the vertical axis and the horizontal axis and what the graph shows.
What is the graph?
Explain the analemma, please.
A-N-A-L-E-M-M-A, I think it is. Analemma.
I don't know what that is. Does it track where the sun is relative to latitude or something like that? It might be one of those things.
Yeah, that's what I think it is. It's like a shape, figure eight.
Yes.
Shape, they usually put it on the globe.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how to explain that.
I'm trying really to remember how to explain it. I looked this up a couple of years ago to explain it. And I'll have to get back on that one to remember it. Yeah,
they will ponder it, Carl. So stay listening, and maybe after our news break we'll have an answer for you. In the meantime, so stay listening. In the meantime, Ann from Madison emailed to say it seems like low temperatures in Madison in June have been consistently 10 to 15 degrees above average. Her home never gets a chance to cool down at night. Is she correct on this? And do you know what causes this?
Well, I don't know if 10 to 15 degrees is right, but I think there were quite a number of days, probably it's still continuing, although I'm not sure of that, but certainly in the first half of the month, the overnight lows were much higher than normal. And that was contributing to us running up a surplus in terms of the monthly average temperature. It was more the overnight lows being high than the daytime highs being higher than normal. And that is a characteristic, as it turns out, of our gradually warming climate, because the water vapor content of the atmosphere rises fractionally with the fractional increase in temperature, and that makes it hotter to radiate away at night during the warm season. So one of the, I guess you could call it, lights are out, people are asleep, climate signals is that the overnight low minimum temperatures are getting higher. And that's where quite a bit of the gradual increase in overall average temperature is being seen.
Hmm. Cal in Sugar Camp, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Is there any chance of that heat dome slowly going across northern United States and hitting us?
The heat dome really, going, yeah.
I think that our science is doing itself a disservice by talking about this thing as a heat dome. This makes it, it's just what we did with the polar vortex. Like it's some new animal that no one's ever heard of before. I really get tired of that. This is a giant region of high pressure, and it does have a sort of a climatological linkage to the high terrain of the western part of North America. So it's very unlikely that we would see the same exact kind of structure that is leading now to these, has led and will lead to a third straight day in a row over 100 degrees in Seattle for the first time ever in its history. They had 3 days in the last 76 years over 100. Now they've had three in a row. Okay, something's
wow. Out.
But that's unbelievable. But the big anticyclone that's responsible for the excessive heat in the West is a feature that pretty much stays in the West. And it either gets larger like it is now at an extreme level, or it kind of weakens away to something that's more moderate. And in fact, one of the things that's an interesting characteristic of the flow that is currently bringing the Northwest such extreme heat is that it's likely to bring us a little bit of moderation, because the downstream side of that ridge will be flow from the Northwest. And that's always welcome here in the summertime, because it does cool us and dry us off a little bit. So, I don't think there's much risk of us seeing that kind of an exceptional heat wave, at least not forced by the exact same mechanism. That is for sure.
Somebody else wondered, would this lack of rain that we had earlier, would that be considered a dry spell or a drought? What is a drought? How long? What do you need to have a drought?
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it'd be considered more of a dry spell. So there are very distinct differences in terms of definitions of what a drought is. And it's usually a combination of a lack of precipitation, but also it has to do with the amount of water flowing in streams, the amount of water in the soils as well. So what we had before, I would say, is just more of a dry spell where you're not getting any precipitation.
Yeah, and if it would have to continue on for a time in order for it to be considered a drought then.
A drought.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes some sense. Well, we've got Bill in Green Bay, and we'll get to you in a couple of minutes here. Our guests today are weather guys John Martin and Steve Ackerman. They'll be with us right up till 12:30, and I hope you'll join Bill and give us a call. Number is 1-800-642-1234. Or email us like Ann and Len did. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news. Find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. Nice to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, Steve Ackerman, a vice chancellor for research and graduate education at the UW, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So what summer weather questions do you have? What do you want to know about weather and climate? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now let's go to Bill, who's been waiting in Green Bay. Bill, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Larry, for taking my call. It's always great to hear the weather guys. I was watching a PBS special about jet airlines, and they mentioned that contrails can cause cirrus clouds. I just want to hear some comment on that. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks again.
I would say they can cause cirrus clouds, but they don't always. And so contrails are, you know, coming out of the back of a jet engine, hot, warm, moist air, and it can form a linear cloud system that just due to thermodynamic mixing. Much like the processes in wintertime when we breathe and we can see our breath. So if the atmosphere is really dry, those contrails don't last very long, and they'll evaporate relatively quickly. If the atmosphere is close to saturation, then those contrails can last a long time, can spread, and can develop a widespread cirrus cloud. But that really only happens under very special conditions.
All right. Thanks for that question, Bill. Fawn in Madison, your turn. Hi, Fawn.
Hi. Hi, I'm calling because a caller earlier on said that the low temperatures have been 10 to 15 degrees above normal, and she noticed that. And your guest said they didn't think that they were that far off. It wasn't 10 to 15 degrees. However, I wish to point out, and this is a big complaint of mine, that the weather data and the norms are recalculated every 30 years and to reflect the norms for the past 30 years, which are necessarily going to be higher than the norms the previous 30 years and the 30 years before that. So perhaps the caller was referring to the historical data, perhaps in her own lifetime, of how the lows used to be before all this global warming started ramping up so severely. I object to this recalculating the norms because it deceives us into believing that it's actually normal for things to be this warm when, in fact, it is not normal for historically and for the planet. Thank you. Any comments? I'll take.
Okay. Thanks, Fawn, for calling. Let's get some comments.
There's a reasonable point there that, you know, sometimes people don't like this recalibrating every 30 years. But the thing is, for to have a reasonably fair record, it's probably a good idea to do it at some interval that doesn't include, you know, records that are hundreds of years old. So it's a matter of where do you decide to do it. And I guess the World Meteorological Organization decided probably in the 60s or 70s to use a 30-year running rolling period. So every decade we re-up that for the last 30 years. But in global warming's occurring, there's no doubt about that. And so things like what Fawn said about overnight lows being higher now than they ever were is probably right on average. If probably not 10 to 15 degrees higher than they were, although you can get a period of a month where you end up, you know, with high temperatures, overnight low temperatures being nearly 10 degrees above normal. I'm not saying that can't happen. My comment was that it probably hasn't. I don't think it did happen in Madison in this month of June, though something fairly sizable was recorded. And I guess the comment is that it's being compared against only the most recent 30 years, so it might seem a little bit less dramatic than it actually is. Perhaps that's true, but it's dramatic enough. I mean, it catches people's attention. So anyway, that's what I would say about it.
Yeah.
And then the only other thing I would add to that is when we do comparisons over, you know, going back to the 1800s, they do normalize it to the, I think it's the 1960s time frame. And so if you ever watch those maps, when you look at the departures from that 100-year average, you can see that it kind of is really close to zero in the 1960 time frame. So they do. It's not always what we're doing that averaging every 30 years. When we do long-term averages, they do normalize it to a different time period.
Fawn, thanks again. Appreciate it. Raul in Oregon, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys? I just want to say I just thoroughly enjoy these two guys. I always learn something every time I hear them. My question, I'd like them to comment on climate change / global warming. I know it's a political hot topic, but when you teach your students, how do you approach the subject, and do you think it's man-made, man-driven, or natural, or a combination of both, or which is the worst problem? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Raul. Appreciate it. John, do you want to start?
Yeah, in the history of the Earth, there have definitely been times when climate change was completely naturally occurring and of similar magnitude to what we confront today. But that is not the case in this most recent example of it, and we have plenty of evidence from almost every conceivable dimension to prove that. In the last 200 years, the temperature increase globally over the hemisphere, measured directly by thermometers, measured by indirect measurements, by ice cores and various other things, tree rings and whatnot, unequivocally talks about an increase in temperature that hasn't been experienced at this rate in the last 8 or so million years. And I think we just last month went over 415 or 418 parts per million carbon dioxide. And there's no particular record of that being part of the atmosphere's composition over the last several million years again. So that and we have records that go back to the 50s where it was around 315 parts per million. So we are responsible for the increase from 315 to 415 in the carbon dioxide fraction in the last 70 years. That's unequivocal, and the consequence of that is equally unequivocal. It warms the planet. So this particular example of global warming that's going on now is directly a function of human activity.
And I think the only thing I would add to that is when I used to teach, I haven't taught in a couple of years now, but it was, you know, as John is referencing, it's always based on data, right? So you can look at what's the global trend in the temperature, what could cause that, what's the other data, and how does that look, and is it consistent? And in the end, you then also ask the question, can we explain this physically? Is it following physical rules? And all of that ties together in a really neat package when you look at what the impact is by humans and burning of fossil fuel.
No, there you go, Raul. Thank you so much. Claire in Sauk County, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I want to ask the weather guys about heat lightning. First of all, is that a real thing or is that just a term we humans that don't know science made up? Number two, if it is real, is there a storm way up there in the atmosphere that's just not coming down to us? Or what else can they tell us about heat lightning?
Thanks, Claire. Appreciate
it. It's a real observation. So anything that's a real observation is science in my mind. And I think Steve usually has a really great explanation for this. I'll let him take it.
No, but I agree with John, right? I mean, it is an observation that people have made. And it's basically regular lightning. It's just you don't hear the thunder. And so typically has that developed with history is it's on hot, muggy days. So there are hot days. You see the lightning. You don't hear the thunder. And so people started calling it heat lightning. And so, yeah, it's a real thing, but it is generating thunder. It's just not reaching your ears.
So it's a real thunderstorm just far away from you, but not far away from you that you can't see the lightning.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's lightning hitting the ground somewhere. It's just you're not seeing it.
Or it may even be cloud to cloud somewhere.
It could be cloud to cloud. Okay, yeah.
Well, there's also temperature structures in the atmosphere so that as the sound wave propagates, it can diverge and move upward because the temperature and the densities of the air can keep it from actually reaching your ears, even though you may only be a mile, 2 miles away. And this is something they discovered during the Civil War. As there was a battle raging, they could hear the sounds of the battle. They're double timing to get to the battle. Then they hit one of these zones where you don't hear the noise because of the thermal structure of the atmosphere. They figured, darn it, we missed the battle. Might as well stop doing double time. Meanwhile, the battle's raging. They just can't hear it. Much like the lightning happens, thunder happens, you just can't hear it. You're in a quiet zone.
Oh, very interesting. Claire, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Randy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Randy.
Hey, good afternoon. I don't want this to sound like or be a leading question, but when you look at the multiple problems with water, earth, wind, and fire, I'm wondering, is having 4 years of an administration that said climate change is very equivocal. In fact, climate change doesn't exist. Would we be further along if we had been able to use these last 4 years to actually hit those problems with all the instruments of government?
Well, I think we would. I think, you know, if you had a fire in your backyard and somebody in your family insisted it wasn't going on and so delayed you from bringing water to the fire, even if it was containable, you might regret that you'd listen to that person for a period of time and let the fire get a little bit more out of control or at least make it more challenging to combat. And that's where we are. Yeah. Every day. Well, I heard somebody say the other day, a day is a day. And every day that's wasted on any problem of urgency is a day that you'll never get back. And it's unfortunate that we spent some 1400 days, you know, in a ham-fisted approach to trying to subvert reality. And maybe we can get past that.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would add to that is it's really important in developing policy to look at what the science is, what the data is. And when you do that, you can advert things like the ozone hole and the continuing development of that. Once we understood what the science was, we knew how to stop the I mean, it's still happening because we emitted a lot of CFCs, but we found a way to slow it down.
Right.
And now we're getting in really good shape.
Yep.
And it took that long, right? That was in 1970. So
right.
As John says, every day that goes by is a waste, and every year that goes by is even a bigger waste.
And I'll add one more statement about that. It's an excellent example. The Montreal Protocol solves the ozone problem. Sure, the first moment or two, the first month or two after it was, there were mandates from governments to do business differently. Businesses probably weren't happy about that. But boy, no one's gone out of the refrigerator business. Nobody's gone out of the business of keeping things cool. So they just find workarounds. We're too smart to let these things conquer us.
Randy, there you have it. Thank you so much for that question. Appreciate it. Let's go to Greg in Minocqua. Greg, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
In my early days, I spent a lot of time in the military service flying the National Science Foundation down to Antarctica for research, which was an excellent tour of duty, but I also learned a lot about historical temperature changes, and you hit on it just a little bit earlier, historical versus average global temperatures. But is there any data out there on an annual basis, annual global temperature data going back to, say, the 1800s? Or is it specific to a geographic area? And then I've got a second question.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Yeah,
there is global data that goes back, but as you're pointing out, the observations are made at a particular geographic site or many, many geographic sites. And so to actually composite what is the global temperature, you have to find really good, clever statistical ways of using those dispersed observations to give a true representation of what it might look globally.
Yeah, the Hadley Center in England does that, though. That record goes back to 1850, I think.
Yeah,
maybe even later than that.
Mm-hmm. Because obviously Antarctica at one point was much warmer than it is even today or will be in the future. But that fluctuation takes place how many years? I guess we're still waiting for that that change.
Part of the reason why the Antarctica was so warm, this is a story that just fascinated me many years ago. There was the race to the South Pole, and Scott lost, and they died. And what they found on his sled was something like either 200 pounds or 200 kilograms of fossils. And those fossils were of tropical plants.
Wow.
And he was just so amazed by that. But by then, they didn't know that the continents moved. And so at that time, Antarctica was at the tropics. It wasn't where it was. And that's why, it just fascinated me that you would see those fossils, know that it's a tropical plant, and wonder, how the heck did that happen?
Yeah, right.
Greg, did you have another question?
Yeah, real quick. We seem to always talk about global warming and climate change on the hottest week of the year, but how come we're not talking about it all year long?
That's a good question, Greg. I'm glad you asked it. For the last, 5 or 10 years, I've been tracking the area of the cold pool, which is temperatures below 23 degrees Fahrenheit, about a mile above the ground, in the wintertime in the Northern Hemisphere. So I've been looking at a wintertime signal, and you know what's happened is the aerial extent of that cold air over the Northern Hemisphere has systematically shrunk since 1948. And so there's a wintertime signal that's global. And it's replicable in every data set I've looked at that tells you that the planet's warming up. And there's really no good explanation for why that aerial extent of that cold air has shrunk, except that there's more retention of infrared energy by the changed composition of the atmosphere. So there is winter signals, too, that say the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's a really clever way of measuring it, too.
Like, Thanks.
Yeah, it is indeed. Greg, thank you so much. John in Wisconsin Dells, your turn. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi, guys. Really enjoying the conversation, so thank you. And I have a question. You know, as I listen to this, I really look into the weather a lot. One of my thoughts is that it's always reactionary. So the weather does something and we react to it. So here's my question. It's a little bit out there, so bear with me. Is there any thought through the scientific world, of which I'm not a part of, like where we could potentially manipulate weather patterns to make it, you know, whether it's safer or better or, I know it's out there, but is there any way for us to be less reactionary and more proactive with the weather from a scientific standpoint?
All right.
That's a great question, and I'll just make a short comment. When numerical weather prediction was first put on the table as a proposition right after World War II, the main motivation for trying to predict the weather several days in advance was to allow us to explode nuclear bombs in the right locations to alter the patterns that were foreseen to otherwise be likely to occur. So weather control and weather forecasting were interwoven very strongly in the late 1940s and the 1950s, and that really didn't even start to loosen its grip until the 60s. I have evidence in my recent book about Reggie Sutcliffe. He goes to give a talk just before he resigns from the Met Office, and the title of the talk is Predicting and Controlling the Weather. This is 1965. So those two have been wrapped up since the idea of predicting the weather by numerical computers, which was immediately after World War II, put the idea into people's heads. That lasted at least 20 years. And I think there's still people who are thinking that maybe we can do some things to alter the atmosphere in such a way as to change weather patterns. I don't want to take up all the time. Steve's probably got something to say.
No, I'll just second that. I mean, it's just way too much energy distributed over a large area that we just don't have the capability to do those large types of changes. I think the only thing we really have changed, and that is unintentionally, is we've changed the climate. and that's starting to change weather patterns unintentionally and not in a controllable manner.
That's right. That's a really good point. We've done exactly the opposite of what we might have hoped.
Oh, man. Well, John, thank you so much for calling. And Wayne, have you got a quick question from Madison? Hi, Wayne.
Yes. I called a couple months ago about the length of sunlight, the number of sunlight hours we have in a day. And at that time, I had been comparing 2020 with 1980, and I didn't find any significant difference in the first couple months. Since then, I found a table in a book published in 1974 that had the length of sunlight in a day on an average for every month. And when I compare that with 2020, there is a significant difference. I mean, it's about twice as much sunlight then as we had in 2020. So I had that comment.
Well, what do you think, guys? We're just about out of time here.
So I would think that it depends on how you're defining the sunlight. Are you talking clear sky type of sunlight? Then I could imagine where the cloud cover is coming in and changing it. But certainly sunlight in terms of measured in terms of sunrise to sunset, that hasn't changed that much.
That hasn't changed. All right. There you go, Wayne. Thank you. And I'll be in Door County around the holiday time. It looks like the weather's going to be nice there. 15 seconds have we got. What's the weather?
I think it's – what does it matter what the weather is in Door County? It's a great place to go. I mean, why are we even talking about that? Why do you have to brag about you're going to Door County at the end of our show?
on that note, we're done. John, Steve, we'll look forward to your visit next month. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, Steve, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, both of them professors also in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. They'll be back next month. We'll talk with them again. Tomorrow we'll learn about canine emergency response teams that helps bring missing people home. So looking forward to that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mehler.